In November of 1987, 6-year-old Lisa Steinberg was found comatose in the Greenwich Village apartment of her illegally adoptive parents, Joel Steinberg and Hedda Nussbaum. Lisa died, and Joel Steinberg was recently convicted of first-degree manslaughter. Charges against Nussbaum were dropped. The fact that this middle-class Jewish lawyer was abusing his daughter and his live-in lover in the heart of Greenwich Village shocked the public and became a major media event. It struck close to home for many people, including my guest, feminist writer Susan Brown Miller. She began writing a novel about the case the day that Lisa died. Waverly Place has just been published, and it has created quite a controversy in the women's community. Brown Miller is a leading feminist author. Her 1975 book, Against Our Will, helped redefine the debate on rape. Brown Miller now finds herself at odds with a large part of the feminist community. When she first saw the battered face of Nussbaum, she saw her as a victim. But as she learned more about what had happened, Brown Miller began to feel that Nussbaum was also to blame for Lisa's death. Some women's groups charge that Brown Miller lacks sympathy for Nussbaum and is blaming the victim of domestic abuse for what happened. Though Waverly Place is fiction, Brown Miller did interview most of the people connected with the case. She was not, however, able to get an interview with Steinberg or Nussbaum. I asked Susan Brown Miller what it was about the Steinberg story that made her want to write about it.
I think I've never been so moved by a case of child abuse and murder. Of course, this case happened in my neighborhood of Greenwich Village. Joel Steinberg was a lawyer who looked like other men I've gone out with in my life. Hedda Nussbaum, in those first extraordinary videotape pictures of her being led into the police precinct, looked like nothing human. I needed to find out for myself and to tell my readers how this couple in my neighborhood could have gone from people I might have known to such a spiral descent into depravity.
Why did you choose a novel, though? Why did you want to fictionalize your story as opposed to doing a kind of
true crime
investigative piece?
Well, I did a lot of investigation. I have my differences with the true crime genre, first of all, because they increasingly rely on reconstructed dialogue. My feeling was that no one was a fly on the wall in the Steinberg apartment. And since the interaction between Hedda and Joel occurred in that apartment when no one was there, interviews with the principals, even if I should have gotten interviews with the principals, wouldn't have told me anything. I'd have to reconstruct the dialogue. So I thought, why make the pretense of this being nonfiction? I'm going to just call it fiction, and that's what it is. But I believe it's a psychological truth about this case.
Well, it's really a very, I would say, thinly veiled fiction, because what seems to be different are their names. But for the most part, he's an attorney. Mm-hmm. She's works for a book publisher. They adopt illegally 2 children, and on and on and on.
Right.
You've stuck with the facts.
As much as I could, yes. I strung a fictional narrative between what I consider to be the signposts. It's like the Via Dolorosa. In this case, it's the stations of the cross. Certain facts about Steinberg and Nussbaum became very well known in the weeks after the murder of Lisa, and I simply strung my fictional narrative along those signposts.
Experts will tell us that family violence really knows no boundaries, that it happens in all kinds of families, in all classes. Is there something of a kind of class bias to be so shocked and upset to see this kind of family violence within a white, professional, upper-middle-class family?
Well, I think quite to the contrary. We all know that family violence cuts across class lines, but we also tend to ignore the fact that, I mean, or at least many people do, that it has its unfortunate statistical position in the middle class and the upper middle class and the upper class. I think, are you asking me why did I choose a middle class case to write about?
Sure.
Because if you are, then my obvious answer is that these people's lives were accessible to me. I had no trouble working my way into the lives of Steinberg and Nussbaum. nothing about them required a tremendous leap. I mean, they were of the same ethnic background as I was, you know, pretty much the same socioeconomic background. So I didn't have to make it up or falsify. I knew who these people were. I just never had any experience with people who chose this route of irresponsibility.
Did you identify with any part of them?
As a novelist, I identified with all of them in turn as I was writing about them. Everyone, including, of course, the little girl. But I did not think... You know, if I started thinking that I would use myself for Judith, who is the stand-in for Hedda, it became very clear to me early on, after I wrote the first scene where she's hit by Barry, the stand-in for Joel, it became clear to me that I was not her and she was not me, because I wouldn't have put up with it.
Have you ever been hit by a man?
The first scene of violence in Waverly Place, where Barry hits Judith after a skiing weekend, where he accuses her of flirting on the slopes in Vermont, that happened to me. Yes, my response was totally different. When my ears were boxed, as Judith's ears were boxed, I was standing in the kitchen and there was a bread knife on the counter, and it was near my left hand, but although I'm right-handed, I picked up the knife. It was such an instinctive gesture. I just picked up the knife with my left hand and I said, "You better get out of here or I'll kill you." I mean, I didn't think about it. I'm not a violent person. I've never hit anybody in my life. But I knew that I had to protect myself at that moment, that something very strange had happened to me, that his violence had nothing to do with the reality. So I thought I'd use that scene as the first time that Judith gets hit. But, of course, her response was so different from mine. She said, "I love you."
Susan Brown Miller is my guest, and her new book is called Waverly Place. You make clear that this is really not a simple tale of a kind of sadistic victimizer and a passive victim, that it's really much more complicated than that. It makes me wonder whether your views about women who are in abusive relationships has changed over time, whether you're looking at this in a different kind of way.
When I wrote Against Our Will, I said that any woman can be a victim of rape, and that's absolutely true. An 87-year-old woman can be a victim of rape. A 2-year-old female child has been a victim of rape. Any woman can be in the wrong situation at the wrong time, walking to her parked car in the deserted garage, and she can be set upon by a number of assailants. She can be sleeping in her own bedroom at 3 in the morning, and an intruder can come in through that window with a knife and put it at her throat. Any woman can be a victim of rape. I do not believe, and I have never believed, that any woman can be a victim of battery. Any woman can be hit once. Any woman can be hit maybe twice. But there are many of us who would choose to walk out, who would not take physical violence. Many of us would not even take emotional abuse. I think that the battered women's advocacy movement, in suggesting that the victim of battery could be any woman, is wrong. They are wrong about this. And the message they're telling women is wrong, if that's what they're saying. Because it says that women cannot make the same adult choices of will that men can make. It's not true. It's also giving too much credit to the batterers. They are not all that powerful. They are not all that charming, manipulative, and effective that any woman who crosses the batterer's path is going to get sucked in by one of them.
Is the important word choose, and that's the word that you've used. And I suppose a relationship over time suggests the fact that you make choices over time.
Well, that's the important difference between the victim of rape and the victim of battery. The victim of rape is a victim once in an isolated, traumatizing incident that can affect her for the rest of her life. The victim of battery chooses to stay in the battery relationship over a period of time. With Nussbaum and Steinberg, she stayed in that abusive relationship for 12 years. That's at least 6 years longer than the average I hear from my friends in the battered women's advocacy movement. So, of course, she had ample opportunity to get out at the beginning, but she instead instituted this process of denial in her head of it won't happen again, or he needs me, or the power of my love will overcome his violence. The real person didn't do this. It was some other person inside him. I mean, they give themselves an extraordinary number of excuses. I've heard them all. I've heard all the excuses. The bottom line is always, but I love him. And again, that's another reason why taking a middle-class case to examine this reciprocal relationship between batterer and victim was more interesting than taking the case of a poor woman on welfare, where there are economic reasons why she might feel she had to stay. No economic reasons in the Steinberg-Nussbaum case.
In all violent relationships, there isn't always violence. I mean, there are seem to be moments of kind of tenderness and forgiveness and promises. Do you think is it the violence that keeps a woman in a relationship, or is it the tender moments?
Well, you're playing devil's advocate here, Marty. You can't fool me. We know that women don't want to be hit. I don't think there's a woman alive who wants to be hit. They do live for the tender moments afterward, when the batterer shows his contrition and they go through a honeymoon period. I would also suggest more provocatively that at least in the case of Hedda Nussbaum and Joel Steinberg, that not only were the honeymoon periods the moment she craved, I think she felt any situation with Joel in which she had his full time and attention was where she wanted to be. And so she put up with the violence too. And of course, as she herself testified on the stand, when they freebased cocaine together, according to her memory, the conversations were all about her, and he was trying to improve her therapeutically.
Leaving a violent man is just the way it's a complicated relationship. It's also a very complicated thing to do. And in the novel, you describe a woman who slowly begins to lose any contact with her social network. She stops working. She becomes more and more housebound, loses more and more contact with the outside world. And I think this is also reflected in the real life case of women who are in abusive situations where they feel exceedingly cut off. Oftentimes, the husband will not allow them any money except for what he gives them. And slowly their world begins to shrink. Their options begin to shrink. And I think it's also true that over or about 50% of women who are killed by former or present partners. Doesn't this, though, create a kind of level of fear and violence that makes it exceedingly difficult for a woman to leave a relationship?
It certainly does in many, many battery cases. And while the Steinberg trial was in process in New York, there were three women on Long Island who had escaped from their batterers, and their batterers hunted them down and killed them. They had the court protection order, which, you know, is a piece of paper and doesn't mean anything. But those women escaped. Those women tried to escape. Those women understood that they were living in fear. That's not Hedda Nussbaum. Hedda Nussbaum did not live in fear of Joel Steinberg, according to her own testimony in court. She also had money in the house that she could have taken any time to escape. Her few escape attempts earlier in their relationship all left Lisa at home. Of course, she was convinced that he was the better parent. But her excessive willingness to submit her destiny to Joel from the minute she met him, I think makes her slightly different from many of the other cases. She wanted, from the minute she met him, to have him be the human god. She wanted him to control her life. And I have to keep saying, because it's such a significant part of this case, the two of them were in a severe state of cocaine psychosis in the last several years. And that is what Hedda Nussbaum was living for. The tragedy for me, I guess, I shouldn't say just for me, one of the many tragedies in this case is that she seems never to have bonded with Lisa. And I think that Joel set up the competitive relationship between Hedda and Lisa, made Lisa his own, as he keeps saying, you know, I was the good father, I was the father. Well, there's no doubt from interviews I had with people in the neighborhood that he was the principal parent. And that until he started cuffing Lisa around in the last 6 months of her life, Lisa adored him, absolutely adored him.
I suppose the larger question that this case raises, and your book does as well, is what responsibility does a battered wife have for the battering death of her child at the hands of her abuser? How do you answer this question? Hedda Nussbaum, the charges were dropped against Hedda Nussbaum so that she could testify against Joel Steinberg.
In all cases, there is a longstanding relationship between two adults who are obviously unfit parents. They're obviously unfit caretakers for a child, an innocent child. In all these cases, there seems to have been a battery of the female by the male, and later it transfers to the child. And in the case of Eli Creekmore, in the case of Lisa Steinberg, the woman in this situation did nothing to save her child. In Eli Creekmore's case, it was the grandmother who battered down the doors of all the social welfare agencies and said, this little boy is in trouble. But in that case, they were tailing me out there in Seattle, the two parents would go through all the social work programs. They went to an anger clinic. They went to parenting clinics, and they did well. They did well enough to fool the social work agencies. In this case, in New York, in Greenwich Village, Joel Steinberg, psychopath extraordinaire, was able to fool social workers who came to his apartment. He had trained little Lisa to, and so had Hedda trained little Lisa, to give phony answers in school and say, my baby brother hit me, and also had dressed her in long-sleeved sweatshirts so the bruises were hidden. The cops had been in that apartment a couple of weeks before Lisa's death on a neighbor's complaint when Joel was beating Hedda. Hedda turned the cops away and said, I'm fine, officers. I have to hold her responsible because if she wished, I suppose there were those who'd say whatever consensual adults care to do among themselves, we have no right to interfere. If Hedda Nussbaum wanted to commit slow suicide, maybe she had a right to buy all kinds of people's ethical codes. But she certainly did not have a right to stand by and let Lisa go to her death, and if she didn't have the wherewithal to act in 1987, she certainly had the wherewithal in 1981 when he brought Lisa home as one would bring home a stray kitten. In 1981, they'd already been freebasing for a year, and Joel Steinberg had already ruptured Hedda Nussbaum's spleen and caused her to be hospitalized. She should have known that the two of them were unfit parents. And that's what I don't forgive her for. And I don't think anyone should forgive her for that. And I hope someday she comes to terms herself. Because I don't think yet she has any understanding of her negligence.
Should she be charged? Should she have been charged equally as Joel Steinberg then?
Well, I wouldn't have charged her equally because I don't believe she struck the fatal blows. But if the DA had asked me, I would have indicted her on reckless endangerment of the welfare of a child, and I think there should have been a public trial because I think that Hedda Nussbaum is now being tried in the court of public opinion. The smokescreen that has been put up around her, she had a very clever defense lawyer who rallied the battered women's advocacy movement to her side. This was when they thought that Hedda would be indicted. So they were treating her the way they treated the women who take that extreme step of killing their batterers. I mean, they were forming a defense committee for Hedda Nussbaum. I told them from the very beginning they were making a mistake in this case. So I think it's unfortunate that the battered women's movement has tried to present her as a pure victim or as some kind of heroine for testifying against Joel when she testified in an immunity deal that has left her absolutely free. Of course, free but disfigured.
Of course, it's always easy for us to say what people should do when we're outside the relationship. And certainly getting back to what you said about a kind of folie à deux, that within the relationship, it's often hard to know what the options are because reality becomes kind of warped. There are sort of moments of clearness, but it's also within a system that is exceedingly self-destructive.
Well, the two of them were a system. They're together. They were a closed system. And since Hedda had begun the denial with the first blows, the second blows, when he hit her in the eye, when he broke a nose, you know, she had put that denial in place so that ultimately she ended up at a point where we would say, my God, that's crazy for her to think that this man was in some way a human god. But for her, it wasn't crazy because she had gotten there gradually over the years.
How did your view, your opinion of Hedda Nussbaum change when you saw her on the stand?
When Hedda testified, I was astonished at how tough she was. I think that was my first reaction. She walked in holding her body stiffly. Now, I understand that it's because of all those fractured ribs. Her body is now stiff and awkward, where she used to be graceful as a young woman. But beyond the face, which is a shock that you never get over, seeing that face, the more I watched her, and she was on the stand for 7 days, the more I couldn't get over how she had picked up not only Joel's values and Joel's belief in Joel's superiority, which she was still struggling with on the stand, but she'd picked up the drug argot. She spoke in a real tough New York slangy voice, using all the colloquialisms for cocaine ingestion. I mean, she'd say, Joel would come, I don't want to imitate her voice, but she'd say, Joel would come home and say, let's smoke. I thought, strange language to use, but that had been her life.
This became a kind of media event, I mean, a real live soap opera. Do you think that that's good for an issue in the long run? Maybe in the short run it is, but in the long run, is this going to help battered women, abusive families, violent men?
Well, I don't think the Hedda Nussbaum case is going to help battered women because the Hedda Nussbaum message has been you can get away with criminal charges and culpability in your child's death if you convince enough people that you were battered so badly that you should be considered a victim. I don't think that's anything that battered women can learn from. Also, you can get on the cover of People magazine with a kind of made-up picture where you almost look pretty again. As for televising this trial, which did turn, I mean, it preempted the soap operas in New York.
Well, it became a soap opera.
Became a soap opera during the days that Hedda testified. It was only her testimony that was broadcast live. I won't say that I'm opposed to the TV cameras in the courtroom because I don't think that journalists need to stand between the public and a news event. You know, I think that it's fine for those of us who are at home to have direct access to an event while it's happening. And everybody in New York who caught a glimpse of Head Alive came to her or his own conclusion, and we're all experts, and there are 1,000 shades of opinion. And I think that's all to the good, because it's a complicated case of a woman who stays in a relationship for so long that she does lose her free will, and who offers the excuse not that she had no options and not that she lived in terror, but that she loved him.
Are you a kind of lone voice among other feminist voices about this issue, or do you reflect a kind of changing opinion within the feminist community about women in battering relationships?
I think that there's no point in trying to shoehorn a case in to fit your politics. If there's a case that doesn't fit, I don't think you should deny the specifics of the case. You see, I'm old enough to remember the old left, and I know what the old left did, particularly in Against Our Will. I have a chapter that's very painful to a lot of old leftists, where I talk about a lot of cases, interracial rape cases, where the old left and the civil rights movement wanted to see in a certain way and weren't interested in the specific facts of the case. And that is what is same scenario exactly with the Hedda Nussbaum case.
So kind of polarization within the feminist community you're talking about.
Yes, I would say there's polarization. There are people who are angry at me, and I'm telling you, the people who don't know the case at all. And I hope that they'll ease up a little and understand that every woman who's been battered is not necessarily a pure victim or a heroine or someone caught in the clutches of a monster that none of us could get away from, and that a victim can also be a victimizer.
Well, Susan Brown Miller, thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for the intelligent conversation.
Thank you.